Moore v. United States, Mr. Lung.
May it please the Court, my name is Gary Lee Young and I'm counsel for Petitioner Appellant Sherman Moore. Now, this is one of a series of gangster disciple cases that have made their way through the court system in recent years, so I won't belabor the underlying facts. But in this case, Moore is collaterally attacking his convictions and his sentences based on the ineffective assistance of his counsel at trial and on appeal. Now, at trial, the crux of the government's evidence against defendant was comprised of the Vienna tapes. And this court, in its published decisions, has alternately described that evidence as the government's strongest evidence, the government's best evidence, the linchpin of the government's case, as well as evidence so crushing that the rest of the prosecution's case scarcely mattered. Now, notwithstanding the importance of this evidence, Moore's trial counsel inexplicably failed to seek to suppress that evidence on the basis of Title III of the Wiretap Act, which requires that...
Isn't this too late? Because haven't we been through these very tapes in a whole bunch of cases and said they were admissible?
Yes, this court has.
So what could this lawyer have done to help your client?
This court can grant Moore the relief that he seeks without overruling Jackson because of the unique procedural posture of this case. Of the 39 gangster disciple defendants, this case is different. This court in Jackson acknowledged that the government's third and final explanation for the delay in sealing was not contained in the SAFER affidavit. But nonetheless, the court went on to accept that explanation as a satisfactory explanation because, quote, the Jackson defendants did not argue waiver of the point by the government in the district court. Now, that was the linchpin consideration of the Jackson court's resolution of that evidentiary issue, because that third and final explanation was beyond the appellate record. It didn't have any support in the appellate record. But that linchpin consideration is absent here. Because of the ineffective assistance of trial counsel, Moore never had the opportunity to argue waiver by the government. And unlike the Jackson defendants, Moore could not have procedurally defaulted this argument.
But what do you do with Judge Easterbrook's opinion in the Hoover case, right? He said that these tapes were admissible.
That's correct, but Hoover involved a direct appeal, and the argument that we're making here, and that this case is procedurally different, was not addressed by this court in Hoover or in Wilson, which was another.
But at bottom, don't we have to look at the finding in Easterbrook that the bottom line is the tapes were admissible, notwithstanding your waiver argument?
Well, also, that was also the finding in Jackson. However, I mean, again, the procedural posture of this case is different, and this defendant is unlike any one of the other 39 gangster disciple defendants because he just didn't have the opportunity to argue government waiver. Now,
he missed a chance to rise to the height of becoming a failure, is what you're saying.
Well, no. We argue that he would not have failed on appeal because had his trial counsel properly challenged the tapes under Title III,
Were the other lawyers who argued the same position in the other cases ineffectual?
Well, I've read the published decisions in Wilson and Hoover, and there's no indication in those decisions that such an argument was raised. So I don't think this court has weighed in a published decision. The argument that we're making here should be rejected. So had his trial counsel not made that mistake, Moore would have had pretty strong grounds to strike that third and final explanation from the government's brief had they decided to raise it for the first time on direct appeal, because it's improper to cite to evidence outside of the appellate record, and as we all know, the appellate record consists of the evidence and submissions made in the district court. And again, without that third and final explanation, there is no satisfactory explanation for the 32-day delay in sealing in the record, and as a result, Moore was prejudiced by his trial counsel's ineffectiveness. That mistake was both objectively
but
unreasonable.
You say that we said in Jackson that the critical thing with regard to the tapes was that the defendants had failed to argue that the government waived the point in the district court. Is that correct?
That's correct.
But if you look at the paragraph that appears in, that's just one point that we made. We don't suggest that that's decisive. We say that for one thing, this ground, about the new recording equipment they were waiting for, had been given by the district judge. Some ground.
That may well be true, but that doesn't alter the fact that the third explanation wasn't in the evidence and therefore should not have been considered on direct appeal absent
the
government.
What do you mean it wasn't in the evidence?
Excuse me?
What do you mean it wasn't in the evidence? It was enough in the evidence to convince the district judge that it was a good reason for the delay in the sealing.
I believe in the district court's opinion it did reference that reason, but it needed to be in the affidavit provided by the prosecutor. And as this court in Jackson found that it was not in that affidavit, therefore it was not in the district court record, and as a result it wasn't in the appellate record.
Actually, we didn't say that. We said it was arguing the government's brief does not appear in Safer's affidavit, which doesn't mean it's untrue, especially since it's one of the reasons the district judge gave, right?
Yes, Your Honor, but even if it is true...
And there wasn't any indication of tampering, so the alternative explanation, they were waiting for this new recording device, seemed pretty plausible. What's wrong with that?
Well, first of all...
it's all highly technical stuff. If there's no indication of tampering, there's no actual reason to exclude these tapes.
Well, the Supreme Court in Ojeda-Rios did rule that proof of non-tampering can't constitute...
I understand, but as a practical matter, if you don't have tampering and you have an alternative explanation which is innocent, even though it wasn't in someone's affidavit, why isn't that a reasonable basis for decision?
This court can affirm on any ground contained in the appellate record, and everything goes back to the fact that that explanation was not in the Safer affidavit, and therefore it wasn't part of the evidence that was considered by the district court or should have been considered
by the district court. Well, it was considered by the district court.
That's correct, Your Honor. But again, it was not in the affidavit, therefore it was not part of the evidence.
Gotcha.
Moving on to our second...
Well, let me just go back for a minute on Jackson. Was that particular argument made on the petition for rehearing, in the rehearing in Bonk, that is, that there was not that affidavit of Safer?
I believe it was, Your Honor, but I don't think we can draw any substantive conclusions from the denial of a rehearing.
Well, I just wondered
petition.
Whether it had been aired in the Jackson matter, and
sure.
Because the whole court also reviewed that. I understand that. I just wanted to find out.
Okay, well, moving on to our second constitutional claim, each of Moore's sentences on counts 2 through 7 was enhanced by judicial fact-finding under a preponderance of the evidence standard. Despite that, Moore's appellate counsel failed to raise a constitutional challenge to his sentences under counts 3 through 7. And at the time that Moore's appellate briefs were filed, there was ample justification within the existing Supreme Court authority to at least make or preserve a sentencing challenge to those 5 sentences. As the Supreme Court held in Mullaney, in the Mullaney case, the Supreme Court strongly suggested that any fact which significantly impacts the extent or severity of the defendant's sentence is a offense element which is entitled to certain constitutional protections. So again, at a minimum, the error needed to be preserved. And the prejudice that stemmed from this error is underscored by the fact that in responding to Moore's writ of certiorari, or petition for writ of certiorari, the Solicitor General in this case stated in its brief that had Moore raised an Apprendi challenge to counts 3 through 7, or sentences on counts 3 through 7, the Solicitor General would have recommended to the Supreme Court that it remand this case for resentencing in accordance with Apprendi.
Let me just get back to that earlier issue for a minute, because there was a case after Jackson, the Wilson case. Was this same waiver argument made by the defendants there? I mean, the argument that the Safer affidavit didn't include that?
Yes, I believe so.
And the court ruled directly in that Wilson case on that point.
Well, again...
Or rejected it, correct?
That's correct.
Right.
But in...
And similarly, in the Hoover case, wasn't the same thing raised, the lack of the Safer affidavit on that point?
That's correct. But
and that was rejected by the court?
Yes, it was rejected by the court. But in each of those cases, there was no ineffective assistance of counsel.
I understand, but I mean that specific issue was dealt with.
You want to save some in rebuttal, or do you want to finish what we were doing?
I'll reserve my remaining time.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Long. Mr. Bindi?
Good morning. May it please the court. With respect to the Vienna tapes, the argument is that had the motion to suppress been filed, a certain sequence of events would have occurred, none of which is certain. What is certain about this issue is that there exists a satisfactory explanation for the delay in sealing those tapes. What is certain is that those tapes were not doctored or tampered with. What is certain is that they are reliable and admissible evidence. And The test for prejudice under the Strickland versus Washington analysis seeks to find those cases where counsel's shortcomings resulted in an unacceptable risk of an innocent person being convicted. And when the evidence is reliable, the evidence that counsel failed to get excluded is reliable, that just isn't the case. On the sentences, we know from several cases following Apprendi that Apprendi does not apply to mandatory minimums, findings needed to set mandatory minimums. And the sentence on the CCE count was a mandatory minimum life. So Apprendi wasn't going to do the petitioner any good there. And as the district court found, because the life sentence on the CCE count stands, there's no prejudice on any of the other counts because the overall sentence would not change. And so for these reasons, we would request that this court affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you, Mr. Bindi. Mr. Lung, how much time does he have? 1 minute? Judge Bauer saved you a minute, right?
Thank you, Judge Bauer.
I'm not sure I did you any favors. Go ahead.
Briefly, Your Honor, on defendant's sentence under count two, we acknowledge that Harris has never been overruled by the Supreme Court and that it remains good law. However, it is not good law which applies to this case because Harris involved a federal firearm statute which applied only incremental increases in a mandatory minimum from no mandatory minimum to 5 to 7 years. Now, the continuing criminal enterprise statute at issue in this case is starkly different. Under subsection A, there's a mandatory minimum of 20 years. Under subsection B, that mandatory minimum is steeply escalated to life. And as a result, we do not believe that Harris applies to this case, even though it remains good law. And this identical approach was adopted by the Sixth Circuit in another case named Harris, which addressed different subsections of the firearm statute. There, the Sixth Circuit found that judicial fact-finding in connection with 10-year and 30-year.
But your argument is entirely, isn't it, within the context of an effective assistance?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Well, how is it ineffective assistance to fail to make such a subtle argument as you're making now?
Well, Apprendi was issued before Moore's conviction became final, and I think Apprendi marked an elemental shift in the Supreme Court's Sixth Amendment jurisprudence. Now, what had been briefed...
But does effective assistance require that you argue that a Supreme Court decision has cast a sufficient shadow over another Supreme Court decision, which the second decision did not purport to alter? Is that part of minimum professional standards to make an argument of that sort?
Well, what appellate counsel should have realized when Apprendi was issued was that Apprendi rendered more sentence on count two unconstitutional under its new approach.
Well, unconstitutional, but cast a shadow, right, over the principle that, you know, mandatory minimum are found by the judge.
That's true, Your Honor, but again, the argument needed to be raised.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And we had requested that you represent Moore in this 2255.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay,
yes, well, we thank you for your vigorous efforts on behalf.
Thank you.
And how?
And court will stand in recess until for future time.